Свою первую годовщину со дня образования отметили войска национальной
Сегодня
гвардии.
Сегодня в России празднуют День войск национальной гвардии.
Отмечают гвардия впервые. Это войско лучшее. Отборная,
Численность
надежная.
Личного состава Росгвардии.
A modern Praetorian Guard, a revival of Joseph Stalin's NKVD, and a 21st century version of Ivan the Terrible's Opричники. The National Guard has been called all of these things, and not just by its critics. Ever since Vladimir Putin established the Guard force last year and placed it in the hands of his uber-loyal former bodyguard Viktor Zolotov, alarm bells have been periodically ringing among the Russian opposition, in the media, and within the elite. With hundreds of thousands of men under arms and reporting to Putin alone, the Guard is seen as both a tool to quickly put down civil unrest or squash a palace coup. As rumblings of protest gather steam and as the elite gets increasingly restless, what role will the Guard play as Russia enters what appears to be a tumultuous political season? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And also joining us from Moscow is military analyst Alexander Goltz, editor-in-chief of Ezhedневный журнал. Welcome to the podcast, Sasha.
Hello.
Great to have you. So, a decree Putin signed last month that appeared to give the National Guard commander the authority to assume control over and give direct orders to regular military units caused a bit of a stir in the Russian media. Just days after that decree was signed, Yuri Boluevsky, who advises the National Guard, published an article in Nezavisimoye Voyennoe Obrazhenie arguing that the main threats to Russian security came from within the country. And this week, General Sergei Milikov told his Vestia that the National Guard was, quote, heir to the NKVD. Sasha, you wrote a piece in Ezhedневный журнал arguing that Putin's decree was a signal that he was preparing to use the military under the command of the National Guard against Russian citizens. Can you elaborate on that, on your argument there for us?
Well, yes. I think when Putin established National Guard a year ago, he answered his main nightmare. He was scared that one day troops will refuse to fulfill his orders to shoot Russian people in a situation of public unrest. It's a nightmare of 1991 when paratroopers under Pavel Grachev's command and special elite forces of KGB refused to arrest Boris Yeltsin. So the Putin's answer was clear: to establish very clear sister chain of command, and that will not permit commanders to avoid. That's why he established National Guard on the base of interior troops of MVD and put Zolotov in charge of it. Now we have all this year. We can see the process when National Guard receives more and more responsibilities and receives more and more rights. And at the end of, for example, recently National Guard said that they will monitor social networks in order to fight against so-called extremists. And they trained special people for this task. And I can give you a number of examples in this field. Mm-hmm. But recently, in the end of May, Putin signed the decree that subordinated armed forces units in special situations to National Guard. And for me, it was striking. Because it's no doubt that National Guard is oriented to fight public unrest. Boluevsky, you quoted, you mentioned his article, wrote that establishing of National Guard is answer on non-military threats. Mm-hmm. And if you read Russian military doctrine, you suddenly find that authors put public unrest on the same desk as acts of sabotage conducted by foreign troops on your territory. So, but it was a big question how to answer this so-called non-military threat in terms of military force. My feeling is that Russian military want to avoid give clear answer, because clear answer means that they had to fight their own people on streets of our cities. So they want to transfer their responsibility to officers and commanders of National Guard. For me, it looks like one more signal that Russian authorities are thinking seriously about forced oppression of possible public unrest.
Now, Mark, you wrote on your blog this week that this decree that Putin signed on I believe it was May 24th, was less than it was cracked up to be in the Russian media, that this wasn't as alarming as it first appeared. What's your argument here?
Yeah, because in many ways, I reach many of the same conclusions as Sasha from very different route. This particular decree was basically a piece of legislative tidying up. There was a previous 2005 decree, which, as amended, addressed precisely the Interior Ministry troops. And it said precisely the same thing, that under certain situations, the president can attach elements of the military to command of, you know, interior troop officers. And this was just simply reflecting the fact that they're no longer the MVD interior troops, they are now the forces of the National Guard. So in many ways, this was a global find and replace piece of just updating legislation. So
where in the past the military troops would go under the Interior Ministry troops, now they go under the National Guard because the Interior Ministry troops are already...
Precisely. I mean, because again, to go back to this, I mean, the thing about the National Guard, it's interesting, is, you know, it didn't create any new force. It just simply resubordinated existing forces. I mean, we're talking about, you know, approximately 190,000 real security troops. Yeah, there's 140,000 who are the former Interior Ministry troops. There's about 40,000 or up to 40,000 Amon riot police, and up to another 12,000 SOBR, sort of police special operations
SWAT
forces.
Type forces.
Yeah, SWAT types. So, you know, those are the ones. I mean, the rest of the sort of the 400-ish, maybe up to 400,000 people within the National Guard are largely their support people or they're parts of FGUP Okhrana, which is a sort of private security firm. Mm-hmm. So they're not really in the same league. But the interesting thing is, exactly, when they decided to create the National Guard, Putin and his cohorts were not actually changing the mindset of the individual security trooper. Just the fact that their badge now says National Guard rather than Interior Troops or Amon doesn't really change their mindset. What it actually does do, though, is it changes the subordination. Mm-hmm. And I think, because I think I want to add this second dimension. Yes, of course, the National Guard is a force to maintain order on the streets at a time when you fear you might need to have a force that can do that and crack heads. But it's also a force to maintain control over the elite. Because I think it came at a time when it wasn't just that the army, of course the army don't want to start shooting at their own people, that's not generally what soldiers want to do. But also the Interior Ministry had been quietly demonstrating a certain degree of dissatisfaction.
Under Kolokoltsev.
Exactly. Kolokoltsev, who after all is a career cop. And okay, I mean, you know, every now and then he comes out with some piece of sort of ultra-nationalist line because he has to kind of protect his flank. But basically, he's a cop's cop and that's what he wants to do. But also, we've had a lot of regional police commands who are actually pushing back, saying, look, you know, if protests do not break the law, it is not our job to disperse them. And so I think it's precisely because it's not just the soldiers, but also Putin was beginning to mistrust his interior ministry. Mm-hmm. That's why he wanted to create this new force under Zolotov, who I know we'll be talking about in the second part, mm-hmm. Assumed to be a sort of a completely loyal attack dog. And so it basically means that even the security elite can't prevent Putin from operating, and it gives him an extra backstop in case of any kind of political coup.
But you come to the same conclusions that Sasha just does.
Yeah, because, I mean, the grand narrative is exactly the same. I mean, precisely. I mean, what Balyevsky was saying is precisely in line with military doctrine and national security strategy. For a long time, the Russians have basically been saying that so-called color revolutions are гибридная война.
Right.
They are Western hybrid warfare, not an expression of the genuine feelings of Russian people.
Right. Now, I also saw a little bit of psyop in what we've seen over the past week. The Balyevsky article, the comments by Melikov, which interestingly enough, I mean, Izvestia scrubbed them from the online version of its site, but screen grabs of the comments continued to circulate on social media after the fact. These things all have Putin's decree. All of these things happened as Russia's heading into serious protests next week. Alexei Navalny is organizing protests on June 12th for Russia Day. And I think particularly Balyevsky's article, which opens by boasting about the presence of the National Guard on the streets during the last round of protests and how they kept the order one way or another. I saw a bit of a psyop. I think that NKVD comment wasn't an accident. Sasha, what do you think? Do you see this, a lot of this coming out to kind of create this aura of the National Guard to frighten people as protests are taking hold?
No doubt. I agree 100%. And their thoughts about NKVD, it's not occasional. Look, because establishing any force structure, you badly need some historical background. Mm. You need something for breeding these people, for instructing them. And it's not occasional that they look for examples not in history of civil war, for example, not in history of late Soviet Union. They found the examples of NKVD unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important for me.
I mean, Ivan the Terrible's Oprichniki comes up disturbingly often as well in this.
It's Russian liberals who remind Ivan the Terrible and Oprichniki. No. They are thinking in terms of brave soldiers who are fighting in terror threat.
Mm-hmm.
And who are ready to fulfill any order of their great leader.
I mean, I also saw this as a message, as Marx suggests, to the elite. Because if you remember, what the victims of the Great Terror, the victims of the NKVD, were largely members of the elite in the 1930s, right? So I think the invocation of the NKVD is also that kind of a message. Go ahead.
I don't think that Mr. Putin has some reasons to ask questions himself about loyalty of a Russian so-called force elite. I think it's not time for this. But again, even if we speak about threat of color revolution, in my mind, such a revolution is hardly possible in our days Russia. But nevertheless, some kind of paranoia exists within top Kremlin leaders who once and once again are speaking about color revolution as a new type of warfare and the result of Western conspiracy. So that's the same way. We cannot exclude that some people in Kremlin are thinking in this about their elites in the same terms. Mm-hmm. If Russian people can betray, why elites cannot betray? Mm-hmm. That's why I can agree that Росгвардия establishing can be the result of such threat assumption, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Mark, do you see a psyop going on here?
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm honestly not sure about whether the NKVD thing was officially sanctioned. It certainly doesn't even really chime. Well, yeah, but I mean, I think all of the media thing, I mean, it's sort of, someone comes with a nice line. It's not like Izvestia, I think, are going to sort of check everything beforehand with the Kremlin. And it doesn't actually really fit with how the National Guard present themselves in their sort of official histories and so forth. I think this is probably someone going a little bit too far, hence the fact that it was scrubbed. But on the other hand, of course, they want to present themselves as being formidable, and therefore not worth messing with. But I think there's also, we've got to bear in mind that this is about one more bureaucratic institution fighting the struggles of any bureaucratic institution. This is also about lobbying. This is about saying, we are the real front line. The real threat facing Russia is not actually from NATO or wherever, it's actually from our own fifth column, and that's why we need our budgets. And again, I think in this respect, it's interesting that at the very time when basically, the defense ministry is haggling over how much of a cut it will have to suffer. You know, it's not if, but how much. The National Guard's budget seems to be still absolutely fine. And indeed, they're actually going out and they're buying all kinds of new toys, including, and apparently they're looking at a remote-controlled anti-riot vehicle.
Yes.
you know, I mean, this is sort of almost like they have to play the same games. So they have to not only present themselves as being incredibly loyal and efficient, but they also have to present themselves as being the people who need to be protected, or their budgets need to be protected.
I also read a piece in Izvestia recently that they were establishing a cadet academy to kind of socialize youngsters into the culture of the Guard and kind of indoctrinate them at a young age.
Which, again, is exactly what one would expect of an institution like this. And again, I mean, the Interior Ministry had its own sort of both higher and, shall we say, lower education institutions and things. So this is now, in a way, part increasingly of the National Guard just simply taking over the bits that it wants.
Right.
And again, so it wants to create a culture or an ideology. The very fact that they actually now have a more or less an ideology advisor,
right,
in Klinstein for, you know, for Zolotov. You know, they clearly have this sense that they want to build some ethos of the Russian
Guard. Is Klinstein now officially their ideological advisor?
He's an advisor to the commander, and you know, his portfolio, which also includes things like press affairs, includes ideology.
Uh-huh. Okay. Interesting. So he's kind of like Zolotov Surkov. Now, I wanted to get into a little of this interagency stuff because I do think this is interesting. And a good way to segue into this isn't the first time that articles have appeared in the media suggesting that the National Guard was going to get control of something at the expense of another force ministry, Silovoy Struktura, if you will. Back in March, Ross Balt reported that the National Guard was making a play to take over the Interior Ministry's notorious and shadowy Center E, a special unit set up to combat extremism. The way I couched this at the time was this would give Putin's Praetorian Guard a brain, would basically give it its own intelligence service. Now, This would give the Guard the capacity to organize networks of agents and informants, conduct searches, tap telephone conversations, intercept electronic communications. The Interior Ministry denied the report, and we haven't heard anything about it since. I always suspected myself that this information was leaked to Ross Balt by the National Guard itself. It looked to me like a bureaucratic power play. Is that how it looked to you, Alexander?
It's quite possible. Nevertheless, it's more or less clear that National Guard commanders want to receive responsibilities of security service. Even if we take this idea to monitor social networks and prepare specialists in military institutes for this task, in fact, it's not a job of power structure. It's a job of security service or law enforcement service. Mm. So I think this tendency can be applied to any of Russian force structure. They want to take more and more responsibilities, more and more resources, and more budget. Speaking about inter-agency relationship, I want to remind you that Putin and Kremlin was more than cautious when they dealt with interior troops in the past. Look, in situation when Russian armed forces passed through the very, very painful reform. Nobody touched interior troops. But the same in this situation, interior troops gradually moved to the all-volunteer status. Now, if I am not mistaken, there are only 16% of conscripts within National Guard units. All others are professionals. And even more, in this situation, units commanders received the right to cite the contract with individuals. And it put special responsibility and established special relationship between commanders and subordinates. And I am, in this term, we can recall Опричнина, and we can recall special relationship between commanders and subordinates.
Mark, what did you make of the Center-E thing? I know we discussed it at the time. You were skeptical of it from the start. The Interior Ministry denied it. The thing's kind of disappeared. Although, has it?
I mean, in general terms, yes. I mean, look, security agencies in the Russian political system are like sharks. They have to keep swimming forward or else they drown. So there's always this sort of tendency to try and sort of, you know, grab something more. Now, I think specifically the E-Centers one was never a runner. It was never really likely for several reasons. One is that a lot of the E-Center's work is actually piggybacking on the intelligence that has been gathered by the ordinary police officers and such and the structures within the rest of the Interior Ministry. Yank them out and actually you automatically also take away most of their sources. But perhaps most importantly of all, actually the E-Center, although technically part of the Interior Ministry, in many ways the Federal Security Service already largely dominates it.
Uh-huh.
They managed to get their guy in charge of that. So, you know, it's already a sort of an interesting case of empire building at work there. So, yeah, I mean, I think that specific one, but exactly, it wasn't really about the E-Centers particularly. It was exactly the sense that they needed some kind of investigative intelligence arm. It's actually a nice line I was actually got from talking to someone who is in the National Guard, who said, and this is his quote, "We know how to kick down doors, but we need to be told which doors."
Uh-huh.
And in a way, I think they want to reach the point when they actually can work out which doors themselves, rather than just simply having to be the muscle for other people.
Well, the more we talk about this, this begins to resemble a super ministry almost.
This is the natural dynamic, and I think this is it. If this does happen, if the National Guard does begin to acquire a real investigative arm, that is the point where immediately it is parking its metaphorical or maybe even its real tanks on the lawns of the Federal Security Service and the Investigations Committee. And on one hand, one thinks, well, maybe this won't happen for that reason.
They got them parked in the Defense Ministry and the Interior Ministry already.
Yeah, but also, I mean, I was thinking back to when the Federal Anti-Drug Service was still a real force and not rolled into the Interior Ministry. It was much, much less actually about fighting drugs and much more about a counterweight to the FSB.
Right.
And I wonder, again, if this does begin to manifest, if these various attempts by the National Guard to acquire that additional role does begin to appear, I suspect it'll begin to appear precisely because Putin is thinking it's time to once again have a counterweight.
Well, this brings me back to a discussion we were having almost a year ago about this MGB, this super ministry of state security that effectively would have reconstituted the old KGB. This is a periodic idea that's been popping up over the years. It kept getting slapped down for the obvious reason that Putin likes to play divide and rule with his Siloviki and doesn't want any one center of power. But there was a sense about a year ago that he had come to the conclusion that now was the time. And remember, Mark, you, me, and Andrei Soldatov had sat in this studio and talked very much about this. And it sounded to all of us like this is finally happening. There was the article in Kommersant about this. It never happened. And now we're watching the National Guard seeming to try to build that empire as well.
Two scenarios apply. One is exactly that, you know, that he... Because there is this clear model of how late Putinism politics works, is that instead of relying so much on divide and rule, it's a handful of super agencies under people he really feels he can trust. And so it might well be that exactly he decides.
How many
Zolotov,
of those are there?
Well, but you know, it might well be that he decides Zolotov is that guy, and therefore precisely bit by bit he will accumulate this super agency. Or it could be that actually, having sort of looked at the MGB sort of model, which clearly would have been FSB dominated,
right,
close up, that in fact sort of Putin decided that this beast was a bit too dangerous. And that, in fact, he's precisely
would run it?
Looking well, precisely. But in fact, actually, that he's therefore finding the need to recalibrate the balance of terror, because at the moment, absolutely, it's clear that the FSB is dominant within the security apparatus. So maybe he feels exactly the need to balance it. So I think it, you know, what we might be seeing is exactly here we have a fork in the road.
Right.
Either this is finally the decision to go for a super agency, or actually, it's quite the opposite. It's deciding, come to think of it, that's too dangerous.
Sasha, you watch these things pretty closely. What do you see happening along these lines? What did you make of the proposal for an MGB about a year ago? And are we starting to see the National Guard try to assume that role?
From the very beginning, I was more than skeptical about the idea to build one superpower agency. All we know about Mr. Putin, he is a very suspicious guy. And very suspicious even to his closest subordinate. He's wise enough not to concentrate all system of information. We know that he ignores open sources of information. He said this not once, that he simply do not trust any printed word. What he really believes is these orange files he showed once to journalists, the reports from security services. And I can bet he will never permit to the situation when he will receive one orange file. Wow.
So you would disagree with Mark that the situation is changing now and it's moving away from this divide and rules?
I think until now, but what we have a rather scary tendency. Look, for last 10 years, we said that Czechists, guys from FSB, took any position on the Russian political scene. And no one believes that Dresden State KGB station was so big, because each time any guy is nominated to any position, people say, okay, he served with Mr. Putin in Dresden. But now we can see something even more scaring. We see how Czechists, how people from KGB are changed by bodyguards.
Mm-hmm.
And Zolotov, new Tula government, people in presidential administration. And for me, it's more scary than FSB people.
Mm.
Because in any case, people in FSB, in KGB, were instructed that they are doing these bad things in order to save our motherland, in order to defend our motherland. In any case, they were instructed and educated this way. Logics of bodyguards, it's totally different. You have saved not your people, not your motherland. You have to defend and save only one person.
Mm-hmm. And that
that was the reason why Zolotov was put on that position. Look, for years and years, the tradition was that military generals from military became chiefs of interior troops. For this reason, generals from MVD, from Interior Ministry, they had no experience in planning big military operations. That's why it was usual that generals from defense, from MOD, came to this position. Zolotov is not from interior troops. He is not from Ministry of Defense. He is a bodyguard. Mm-hmm. And believe me, it looks rather serious.
This is actually the perfect segue, Sasha. You actually created the perfect segue to move into the second half of our discussion, where we're going to talk about Zolotov. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and zero in on the man who runs the National Guard and who is emerging as the Kremlin's main boogeyman and scarecrow. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And joining us from Moscow is military analyst Alexander Goltz, editor-in-chief of Ezhedennevny Zhurnal. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
А вот и главнокомандующий войсками Национальной гвардии
Виктор Золотов провел оперативное
совещание. Поздравил директор Федеральной службы войск Национальной гвардии России.
Директор Федеральной службы войск Национальной гвардии Виктор Золотов.
So Victor has been protecting Vladimir for a quarter of a century. Back in the early 1990s, when Vladimir Putin was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, Viktor Zolotov served as his chief bodyguard. And it was a highly unusual and highly lucrative arrangement. In 1992, Zolotov co-founded a private security company called Baltic Escort, and Putin arranged for it to get the contract for protecting top city officials. This not only quickly made Baltic Escort the top security firm in town, it also gave it impunity in shaking down local businesses and forging ties with organized crime groups. And since those days, Zolotov hasn't left Putin's side. And now he's not only protecting Putin the man, he's protecting the Putin regime. Mark, how does Zolotov fit into the constellation of the Siloviki? Who are his allies? Who are his enemies?
It says a lot that if one tries to think, well, who are Zolotov's allies? Well, it's Putin, his ally boss,
yeah.
And Kadyrov, and Ramzan Kadyrov. Beyond that, actually, there's a distinct dearth of evidence of any particular connections. I mean, yes, at time to time, one sees sort of a photo op with him having a laugh with Shoigu or whatever, but actually, there's very little evidence of any real connection there. This is essentially a bullet catcher who has been sort of highly promoted into this position when he's clearly his position is exactly to be the one who watches the watchers. People who have met him do not describe him as an elegant and subtle mind. He is something of an outsider. In some ways, he's a little bit like Bastrykin, head of the Investigations Committee, who, again, part of his strength is precisely that he doesn't have a huge network of allies. So he's regarded by Putin as loyal because he depends on Putin. Well, likewise, very different sort of person, but nonetheless, Zolotov. I think, again, part of what makes him appealing to Putin, apart from just his evident sort of long-term commitment, is precisely that, at the moment at least, he doesn't seem to have that wider network.
Does he have enemies?
I'm not sure if enemies is the right word. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are unimpressed with his connection with Kadyrov, who are not particularly impressed with his...
That cannot endear him to the FSB, for example.
Well, no, exactly, but I don't know if I'd necessarily elevate that to the level of enemies. Mm. It may well be, but I just certainly haven't picked up on that kind of personal vibe, shall we say.
Sasha, how do you see Zolotov fitting into the whole constellation of this of the Siloviki right now?
From personal point of view, there are two groups of Siloviks, if you like. Those who were nominated by Putin, who are responsible to Putin, and whom Putin gave everything they reached. And Zolotov is the clear ideal example of such Silovik. And other people, they want to show themselves as very loyal to Mr. Putin, that they are fully subordinate to Mr. Putin, but they cannot avoid that they have their own biography. they have their own authority. Look at Shoigu. Mm-hmm. This guy, he was one of the most popular ministers in Yeltsin government. He was one of the popular politicians. Now he want to forget all this stuff. He never try even recall that he was something except Mr. Putin's subordinate. But nevertheless, he cannot avoid his own biography. Mm. I think, if we speak about Zolotov, he is absolutely opposite. Everything he has, he received from Mr. Putin's hands. If Mr. Putin disappear, Mr. Zolotov will become nothing in one moment. I think it's very serious.
Mm. Mark, would you agree with this classification of these two types of Siloviki, the ones like Zolotov who owe everything to Putin, and those like Shoigu who are basically have an independent history and
I think actually I broaden it out. I would agree, but I would actually say that it applies much more widely than just the Siloviki. So yes, you know, you've got the Zolotov or indeed the Bastrykin, but you've also got figures like Vino. In the presidential administration, you know, sort of crucial position, but no one else would have said, oh, well, he clawed himself up there and no one could resist him. You know, you actually, in some ways, I think you're seeing a twilight precisely of, I mean, Shoigu is in almost everything a sort of a special case, but, you know, people like Ivanov, the former presidential administration chief.
Who was proven to be dispensable.
Exactly, but on the other hand, precisely, in part, he was dispensable because he was a formidable figure in his own right. Even if one looks at, you know, apparently exceedingly loyal figures like Patrushev, Security Council, Bortnikov at the FSB. But again, exactly. I mean, these are people with their own backstories and their own networks. Again, I think this is a key thing. It's not just, you know, they have a CV, but the point is the CV gives them both authority and it gives them connections with other people. And that's what I think Putin finds problematic.
And so this accounts for the rise of Zolotov. Who other than Zolotov fits this category then? I mean, in the Siloviki.
Well, I said, I mean, I think Bastrykin is the only other sort of obvious figure in the sort of the top rank. But again, because we haven't really seen a bloodletting. I mean, Zolotov could be elevated because they created a new agency. Bastrykin was elevated by creating, in effect, a new agency. Right. You know, I mean, I think what we haven't, it'll be interesting to see if we actually see the sorts of shift within the security agencies as we've seen within the presidential administration.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's worth just one other thing I'd want to mention. Again, understand someone by looking at their friends. If one looks at Zolotov, the only other relationship that's worth mentioning is Korzhakov.
Mm-hmm.
Before Putin was Putin. Anyone. You know, back when Zolotov was, you know, because after all, this is a guy who he was a conscript within the KGB border guards.
Right.
Then went into the KGB's ninth directorate, which is its bodyguard service. And there he got to know Korzhakov. Mm-hmm. And he worked with Korzhakov on Yeltsin security detail, including the sort of fateful, you know, protecting Yeltsin during the 1991 coup. And we know that, you know, Korzhakov, likewise, deeply unpleasant, deeply corrupt, committed exactly to the advancement of his and his principled cause over anything else, including sort of minor details like legality and morality.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that was a lesson, that was a formative experience for Zolotov too, even before he got to know Putin.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that's interesting about Zolotov is that, as I mentioned in my remarks at the start of this segment, is the history back with Baltic Escort. And this is, I think, it's almost a microcosm of the Putin regime. It's, again, my one of my favorite phrases, the spook meets the godfather here in a lot of ways, because Baltic Escort was essentially a protection racket that also had the contract of protecting the top officials in the city government, including not just Putin, but then Mayor Anatoly Sobchak and his family. But this gave it the ability to just shake down local businesses, forge ties with organized crime groups. Putin played this role. One of the roles Putin himself played in St. Petersburg was as the vital link between the city's legitimate authorities and the underworld that really ran the city. And Zolotov was by his side in this enterprise.
And it's worth mentioning one other thing. I mean, what happened to Zolotov's partner in Baltic Escort?
He was poisoned.
Mysteriously.
Mysteriously. 2004, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, and then that was... It's still not solved.
And they will tell no tales.
And they will tell no tales. This speaks volumes about the nature of this regime. Sasha, any thoughts on your side?
It's no doubt for me that to understand this regime, we should read once and once again Mario Puzo novels.
Or watch Goodfellas.
The problem is not only in their CVs, not only in their past. The problem is the mentality that we can at least compare with Puzo's characters. And from here, problems of this regime evaluate. Big boss never can resign.
Right.
Or he can resign only one way. That's why Mr. Putin, who is a balancer of all interests of different groups, who never gives direct orders, but just advises his subordinates to think about this. And that's why reserving his right, were they good or bad in this thinking. So these manners brings us, and of course this regime and the decision-making process is totally closed. That's why this regime has the problems it has now.
Mark, you're writing, so you're thinking. What are you thinking?
I was just, again, thinking, and obviously if we particularly think in the sort of good old Godfather sort of terms, look, everyone becomes something else over time. There's always a narrative arc to all these characters. I mean, likewise, Zolotov, we portray him, and there's no evidence at the moment to say otherwise, as this absolutely loyal figure who owes everything precisely to Putin. But this is now for the first time when he is genuinely an autonomous player within the system. Up to now, okay, even when he was head of the Presidential Security Service, that was actually part of the Federal Protection Service.
But now he's
an independent player. And the very fact of things like the sort of the suggestions about taking over eCenter, again, sort of demonstrate the empire-building dynamics that we're used to. He has, in FGOP Okhrana, this private security agency, a really quite powerful economic asset. And it's one of the reasons why it was transferred. It was obviously to subsidize the National Guard. But it had a profit, an annual profit of 200 million rubles, about $3.5 million. Now, in the past, when that was part of the MVD, that provided a source of some moonlighting for ordinary cops, a little bit of slush fund for various police commanders along the way. Well, likewise, this actually might well give him a bit of a slush fund and an opportunity to begin to become a player in the sort of the economic political world of higher Russian politics. So what interests me is that you find someone who seems to be entirely your homunculus, your creature, and you elevate them to a position where actually they can begin to become, shall we say, actors, characters in their own right. And it'll be interesting to see just how Zolotov evolves, whether he continues to be nothing more than Putin's loyal shadow, or whether, if this system continues in a few years' time, we'll be looking at how Putin tries to balance the National Guard.
Right. I was thinking along slightly different lines about, does the future belong to the Zolotovs or the people with the connections? And now you're saying that Zolotov is going to turn in to the people with the connections.
That is the natural dynamic. I mean, whether he actually ends up sort of socially part of them or anything like that. But I think, again, at the end, the point is that yesterday's loyal henchman is always going to be today's sort of aspirant wannabe godfather.
Mm. Well, that's a nice way to wrap it up on that note. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And joining us from Moscow has been military analyst Alexander Gold, editor-in-chief of Yezhidnevny Journal. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening, interesting, and fun discussion.
It was a pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, Sasha. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFURL's Russian-language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.